birds of a feather, what Maine birders have in common, and how you can join the ranks. Can you tell a nuthatch from a waxwing? Well, don't be ashamed or discouraged. It takes time to identify birds commonly found in Maine, to recognize their songs, and to know when they may happen to be coming or going, or are here all the time. But birding is a popular hobby in Maine. There are people out there who can steer you toward a better grasp of the avian world. I'm Keith Shortall, and today on the program we'll introduce you to several of those people. We'll also learn more about why this time of year offers a special opportunity to see some interesting birds. And we'll explore some of the changes in the kinds of birds commonly seen in Maine, and steps you can take to protect the habitats of important species. And of course, we want to hear from you, so get your checklist and your camera. As Maine Calling goes birding, first this news. From the MPBN studios, I'm Keith Shortall, and this is Maine Calling. Mid to late September is considered peak migration for the millions of birds passing through Maine on their way south for the winter. With a little luck and a little knowledge, you might be able to see snowy owls, Bohemian waxwings, snow geese, and many others. Today we have a panel of expert birders to help us know when and where to find these species. We'll also discuss how climate change appears to be changing the range of these birds. With me in the studio, Doug Hitchcox, who is staff naturalist at Maine Audubon. Derek Lovich, owner of Freeport Wild Bird Supply. Derek also regularly leads bird watching expeditions. And Patrick Keenan, with the Biodiversity Research Institute. Patrick is outreach director for the organization and director of the River Point Bird Migration Center in Falmouth. And as always, we want to hear from you. Are you a birder? Are you on the fence, just starting to show interest? Have you seen anything extraordinary recently? Our phone number is 800-399-3566. That's 800-399-3566. Email address, talk@mpbn.net, tweet at Maine Calling, or post to our Facebook page. You can also paste to your Facebook page if that works for you as well. Welcome, all of you, first of all, to Maine Calling today.
Thanks for having
me. I'm going to start with our Audubon expert here. There's a study out as of this morning, I think it's been published, Doug, where from National Audubon that suggests that climate change threatens nearly half the bird species in the continental United States and Canada, including the bald eagle and dozens of iconic birds, including the common loon, Baltimore oriole, and brown pelican. Now, this is a study published today. As I said, it identifies 126 species that will lose more than 50% of their current ranges, in some cases up to 100% by 2050, with no possibility of moving elsewhere if, and this is the key, if global warming continues on its current trajectory. We see a lot of studies like this, the sort of warning about what's going to happen if we don't do something about climate change. Give us your take on this study. How important is it? Why should we pay attention to this now?
So it's the 2014 State of the Birds report. The really important thing I think to notice about it is that it's also very conservative. You see lots of reports that come out that say, you know, we could lose a lot of, you know, large populations of birds. It's really backed by some pretty sound science, and even given that, it's a pretty dismal-looking report. So definitely things like climate change it's just covering the report, but then it's also things like habitat loss, which can also just be a result of that climate change.
So, and you know, it's human nature to sort of read reports and to want to see some of this play out now. That is, when you see numbers such as, by 2050 or 2080, for some folks, it's hard to get traction, and how do we possibly know this is the fate of these birds by that point? Is there evidence now of changes in the species mix, the diversity that we're seeing of common species that we've known in Maine that's changing, either in their presence at all or in their range?
Absolutely. So there's some species that we're just seeing, you know, they're slowly moving their range northward. especially through long-term trends that we can see with our annual Christmas bird counts. Eastern bluebirds, a quick one that comes to mind, where each year we tend to see more and more of their numbers increasing, especially here in southern Maine, which might have been an area that it was a little too cold for them. But as they're as time is passing, we're seeing more and more year after year spending the winters locally.
Have any of you other folks, other guests here on the panel, seen evidence also of this changing?
Certainly, Keith. I think along those lines, we see that cardinals are increasing and Carolina wrens. And it seems that, a number of these cosmopolitan species are actually the species that are performing pretty well when we look at the species that are advancing northward as well. By cosmopolitan, I mean that they're feeder birds, so they come to feeders, and they actually do fairly well in suburban environments.
Right, example. So they're dependent upon the kindness of strangers in terms of their...
Well, yeah, they may not be dependent upon it, but they're able to use those habitats.
Right. Yeah. We can talk more about the study and some of the ecological, environmental issues that we're facing. But I wanted to start off just in general talking about the subject of birding. I was watching the other day, somehow on came an old episode of the Beverly Hillbillies, and Miss Jane Hathaway, she was in her birding outfit, and it took me back to a time, in the 1960s when I was young, and at a time when if you were a birder, that was sort of the ultimate in nerdiness. Like this was, if you wanted to paint a character as a nerd, it was, oh, well, make them a birder with binoculars and the hat and everything.
Khaki,
right, and being able to reel off the names of these various species. Derek, has that changed? Is it cool now?
I think it is. I think it's no longer, when you're looking at something that's grown to what's now a $20 billion industry, it's not a little cult counterculture thing. There are certainly people that still and always will fit that stereotype. Some embrace it now. We certainly have that trend of, hey, this is who I am, and just be as big of a dork as he can be. There's also people that you wouldn't see as a birder in their what they do professionally and personally, yet find what we all find, which is just enjoyment in the natural world, whether it's an escapism or a dedicated passion. It's all types, and it's no longer, there's certainly no stigma. At least I haven't seen it. We have major motion pictures based on birding. We still don't have that one huge celebrity out there that's making it cool for everyone. We need some pop star to come out as a birder, and then we'll be all set.
So what is it that, you sort of mentioned a few of the things that lure people into the woods, but is it just another excuse for a nice walk in the woods, or are people really fascinated by birds? Talk about some of the reasons that people do this.
Yeah, and I think you've hit on two of the big ones is, humans have been fascinated with birds and envious of birds since we've been around and looking at things, whether it's studying the amazing aspect of flight and trying to mimic it, or just enjoying sitting down, closing your eyes, and listening to birdsong. I'm sure some listeners of this program enjoy the early morning birdsong, and it's nothing more than what we hear on a daily basis by going out in the woods. It is nice to as an escape, but it's also... there's so much going on and so much to learn. And certainly, to bring it back a little bit to the report, a lot birds can teach us. And it's not just about how to make a better airplane, but what our world, which we also live in, is what's happening in that world.
The canary in the coal mine, as we often say. Patrick, what was your did you have a personal interest in birds growing up?
Yeah, before I say, I have always had an interest in birds and as a child and especially being outdoors. But I think to get back to what Derek was saying is that, the environmental movement has in some ways been advanced by the birding community in very strong ways. And with this recent report, we see that there's, again, another statement of the threats to birds, which is another signal of the threats to all of our lives as we know them here. And so I think that there is this representation and realization of people that, birds are interesting in many ways, and they are this kind of window into the natural world that we are losing. For me as a child, I remember being a Boy Scout and we would go, actually it was in Cub Scouts, not in Boy Scouts, and we'd go on snipe hunts in the forest. And I always, you know, this is before I knew anything about what a snipe might be, and we were not in snipe habitat, you know. And it was just one of these kind of mysteries that people, you know, we bought into. And then it became very real once we started learning about birds. So I think for my part, there are a lot of connections to birds. And
Yeah. And Doug, did you have an interest in birds as a kid?
I got into birding actually through photography, which is a fun thing to see. You know, it's not just like there's a single birder out there. There's some people who are interested in, you know, just the rarities, or people who like it because it's a piece of art to them. And one thing I'll just add that, you know, birds are very accessible to people. You know, you can see them out your window. You can travel far distances to look for them. You know, separating them from like mammals. Like I bet I would love to watch, you know, bears more often. But they're hard to look for. You know, birds are really all around us.
No one goes out shrewing, for example. Right. Or there's not a big shrewing movement, at least that I know of. So part of this though is, so in the same way that some might collect coins or stamps, do some sort of collect their findings of birds? They have a list and on their bucket list is like one last species they have yet to find.
Absolutely. And yeah. In my guiding, I see the entire range, and I fit somewhere in the middle of where it's just going out and looking at birds. The term bird watching was sort of pushed out for birding, which is more active and sounded cool and maybe not as stereotypical as what the earlier bird watcher idea was. But some really just like watching birds. Others are listers, where the sense is all they do is care about the collecting of a list, not unlike stamps or trophies on a wall. There's all types in between. And here in Maine, we have not just in our community, but those who travel to Maine have interest in sort of casual observation and very dedicated. And one of the things I specialize in doing is I want to see this, this, and this. Where do I go, and will you take me? And so there's definitely a sizable element of that.
And we'll talk more about that. That's interesting. 1-800-399-3566 to join the conversation. That's 1-800-399-3566. And I will ask our venerable board operator here, Jonathan, to queue up. I have a few audio clips that I was hoping we could do. And the first one, I'll just let you know what we're going to do, is I'm going to play a little backyard sampling of three fairly common birds. I got this from the Cornell website, which is pretty cool. And there's three different ones. You can what we'll do is play it, and then you guys will all, I'm sure, easily identify them. Our audience can listen to them, and then we'll come back and identify each one. We'll do that in a moment while we're getting ready for that. But I look at this actually from a personal experience, and as we were talking before we went on air. I had no interest in this. I tried. I knew it was an important issue. Never really got traction with me in college. It wasn't until years later, when I had kids in a backyard, that I started to notice the calls, and I got excited when I could hear a call and look out the window, and there was the bird that I had heard, and it wasn't foreign or impossible for me to do. Since then, however, about four or five birds deep, I kind of hit a wall, and if they're not colorful or have a really identifiable song, it's kind of frustrating to know what's going on there. Is that pretty typical?
Well, I'd love the opportunity, this is Patrick, to speak to this, because I think with a lot of novice bird watchers, that's something that they face. And, you know, I think that actually, what you're pointing at is the development of skill. So you're continuing to develop skill, and that requires time. You know, if you think about learning math, you know, you have to practice math a lot, you know. And one of the ways to overcome that frustration is to do things like sign up for a walk with Maine Audubon and spend a little time with Doug Hitchcocks, or to go on a trip with an expert like Derek, or to just develop a group of friends who can share knowledge together. And that's a great way to be social, to really get the inside word from an expert, and to really develop those skills, which then become very transferable skills when you know that, oh, this is definitely a cardinal. I know the cardinal. I know the bluebird. Oh, that's a warbler, which is sort of a group of birds that can be very cryptic and difficult to identify. You can start picking away at those birds that you know very well. And so I think that then becomes just another level of skill, which is an observational skill, which if we look ahead and we're trying to develop a, you know, students who can learn and engage with the natural world, that's what we want to see happening.
All right, let's do our little exercise as we head into our first break. And so what we're going to do is play, these are three different, very common Maine backyard bird calls, again, taken from the Cornell website. We'll play them, we'll take our break, and we'll come back and we'll see how our listeners did. Jonathan? Oh, okay. This is actually going to be three birds in this particular file. And that was it, huh? No. Okay, that was actually five birds. We played all of them there. I was hoping just to do the last three there, but that's fine. So we'll come back and we'll play those again, and we'll go through each one and see if we can identify them. In the meantime, we want to hear from you. The number is 800-399-3566. Email talk@mpbn.net, tweet at Maine Calling, or post to the Maine Calling Facebook page. Take a short break. We'll be right back.
You make Maine Calling possible, as does Casella, dedicated to improving air quality for all Mainers through a commitment to reduce its carbon footprint. Casella, giving resources new life. By Revision Energy, now offering Own Your Power loans for solar energy systems. More at revisionenergy.com. And TIAA CREF Financial Services. TIAA CREF Individual and Institutional Services and Teachers Personal Investors Services. More at TIAA.org.
Which are you, a morning person or a night owl? Here's why I ask.
People can be ethical at one point in time and unethical at another point in time.
I'm Kai Rizdahl. Chronotypes, what they are and why they matter. Next time on Marketplace from 8 p.m.
Join us this evening for Marketplace at 6:30 here on MPBN.
And welcome back. This is Maine Calling. I'm Keith Shortall. Today on the program, Fall Birding in Maine. With me in the studio, Derek Lovich of Freeport, Wild Bird Supply, Patrick Keenan, Biodiversity Research Institute, and Doug Hitchcox of Maine Audubon. We invite you to join the conversation. Call 1-800-399-3566. That's 800-399-3566. Email talk@mpbn.net, tweet at Maine Calling, or post to our Facebook page. And we'll go to calls here in a moment. But I want to play back the last file there. It has three different very common Maine birds in it. And I wondered if we could play that back, and then we'll have you identify each of them as they come up.
It's a scold call of our black-capped chickadee.
Black-capped chickadee, the Maine state bird.
And then it's Phoebe's song. Most people think that's an eastern Phoebe, but it's actually the song of our black-capped chickadee.
Okay. And here's the next one.
Yeah. Well, that's a lovely cooing of a mourning dove.
Yeah. Classic.
Yeah.
And these are variations of the song of the Northern Cardinal, new on the scene in Maine and tied in nicely to our earlier discussion.
Yeah. And there's that chirping, that harsh sound that I hear oftentimes at the feeder. And I'm not sure what the cardinal is saying when he's at the feeder doing that. Do we know?
That's a good question. It may depend on the general surroundings, and I don't know, and other thoughts.
We can separate song versus call.
Sure, let's talk about that, because I just sort of made some recordings here, but birds don't have just one thing to say or one reason to say it. There are songs and calls. What's the difference?
A song is an advertisement to other males or to members of the opposite sex, usually the male displaying for the female in most species. The song is the advertisement. Hey, I'm great. Listen to my voice. A call is very has a lot of meaning, and it could be contact between a pair, an adult telling a youngster to take cover. It could be communication among a flock. There's all sorts of things that are transmitted through very simple sounds. In fact, the chickadee call that Doug identified there, the chickadee-dee-dee, which the bird is named for, there was a study done that found the amount of D's are directly relevant to the perceived threat that they've encountered. And in one of the only examples of certain of other species understanding a language of a different species is that red-breasted nuthatches that often travel with black-capped chickadees react appropriately to the number of D's. So they're understanding the chickadee's message, which is a rudimentary form of a language where they're putting sounds together to convey a very specific and rather important meaning.
So these are the kinds of things that can happen in the field. If you're a novice birder and you want to go out into the woods and it's a cacophony of different, it's hard to separate and identify the songs. An experienced birder can help you sort this out? Patrick?
Yeah, you know, they can help. I think that there are also a lot of resources available, such as, you know, the Cornell Lab of Ornithology provides access to many different versions of bird calls. And, and getting back to what we were talking about, bringing birders and is birding more popular, you know, one thing that didn't come up when we were discussing that is the number of resources available to bird watchers and the amount of information that we've learned in the past 20 years. But certainly, being in the field with an expert is without a doubt the number one way to being able to identify a specific bird and begin to learn the sounds that it makes, its behaviors, because you're seeing it there in real time. And
yeah. Doug, I heard geese flying over my house the other day. Reminded me of what time of year it was, and it's sort of a melancholy feeling for me for some reason. As they're yelling and squawking on their way by. But this is a really interesting time of year in general for birding because of migration or other types of movements of birds. Talk about that if you would.
Absolutely. So it's a fun time of year, especially during the fall. We see, you know, different groups of birds kind of peaking at different times. Shorebirds have been moving through for weeks already now. We're starting to see, you know, songbirds, the small neotropic migrants are finally starting to ramp up. In a few more weeks, that's when waterfowl, things like those geese, will really start moving. And so it kind of gives you a nice drawn-out period of lots of diversity in Maine. And just to add to our last comment, learning birds, you really can't beat time in the field. You can read all the books you want, but spending time in the field, especially with someone that knows more than you, you just start to learn things like whether it's that song, the behavior birders refer to, you know, the gestalt of a bird, the way you might recognize a friend is often how you can recognize birds.
Yeah, interesting. From Twitter, the crested, is it Karakara, has been spotted in Norwich Walk. Will there be more of these rare bird sightings, or is this unique?
So this is the first time this bird's ever been seen in Maine. There's a little pattern of vagrancy for them in the Northeast. There's records from Nova Scotia, New Brunswick, New Jersey had one a few years ago. Some might be the same bird that's just moving around a lot, but there's probably a few individuals here. So there could be a pattern here. It's a bird that, you know, you typically see. There's a resident population in Florida. They're down into Texas. I think Derek might be able to attest to this bird.
Vagrancy is certainly one of my most common topics of discussion and interest. And this bird's a vagrant. It's gone too far, we want to say, the wrong way. But to put in perspective, if there was no vagrancy didn't occur, islands wouldn't have birds. There'd be no bird Galapagos finches that Darwin studied. There'd be no birds in Hawaii. Vagrancy is a mechanism that birds find new places to live. Sometimes it's what would be simple miswiring, perhaps due to chemical contamination or just due to the simple fact that sometimes genes mutate in the wrong way and things just don't go right and they fly the wrong way and they're taken out of the gene pool and that's natural selection at its rawest form. Other times, vagrancy is a mechanism that some species have built into it to allow them to disperse to find new ranges. In the face of climate change, in the face of drought in the Southwest, vagrancy may be a mechanism that allows some of these birds to move.
Some of them may not survive, but those that do will adapt to the new place.
Right. Some vagrants have survived. That's why there are birds in Hawaii, if vagrant land birds, that is. So a lot of them, you know what, that's natural selection. They didn't do the right thing. They flew north instead of south. It got too cold instead of being in the tropics. That's not a good thing. But birds are amazingly resilient and adaptable when given the chance and resources. And if this caracara finds good resources in the area it's frequenting, there's not a lot of reason why it couldn't stay, or come back, I should say. It probably wouldn't be able to survive the winters. Physiology has a lot to do with where a bird can, how long a bird can survive in a certain area, but it all comes down to food.
It does come down to food. It's not as much temperature.
Temperature has direct role in food. The birds that fly to the tropics, Doug and Patrick have mentioned migrants and neotropical migrants. Birds that fly to the tropics for their winter. It's actually tropical birds flying here to take advantage of our summer bounty of food. There aren't bugs here in the Maine woods in the winter, thank goodness, because we have more than enough in the summer for ourselves. But there are no mosquitoes in January. So a bird that needs to eat flying insects needs to fly farther south.
Let's go to the phones now, to Serena. Hi, Serena.
Hi.
Yeah, go ahead, please.
Oh, great. I'm loving this show. This is great. I'm calling from the L.C. Bates Museum, and I'm just calling to say, you know, the piece about education is so important, especially with children. And one of the things we do here is actually do a lot of programs for kids. So we've got a fall bird migration program coming up, and one of the things we'll talk about is how migration works, and then also, you know, we will mention a bunch about some of our resident birds, like the chickadee, how its brain grows by 30% in the fall, so it can remember where all its seeds are buried. So thank you for having the show.
All right, Serena, thanks for joining us here today. Kids seem to be naturally interested in birds, right? I mean, from the point that you tell them that they're a close relative of the dinosaur, suddenly birds are really cool. Do you find that, as we get older, we're distracted away from our natural interest in something sometimes?
We were talking before about getting into birds. I started as a first grader loving dinosaurs. So I feel I just evolved like dinosaurs did and became a birder as they became birds. So it was a natural process. But the current evidence really suggests birds essentially are dinosaurs. Dinosaurs didn't go extinct. Just the big, cool ones did.
Right, right.
Keith, I would love to chime in on this because one of the things I'm very privileged to do is spend time educating students with birds in the hand, so physically showing them live birds after they've been banded and processed at our banding lab. And you know, there are very few things more captivating to a third grader or a kindergartner than being able to witness a very small bird fly away, look at it up close. And I think it's just one of those things that the natural world is captivating to young people. And I think you hit it on the head when you said that we get very distracted as we become people.
1-800-399-3566 to Harrison and Bill. Hi, Bill. Welcome to the program.
Hi.
Yeah.
I have had some experience in the past with cardinals coming and pecking on my windows, and this goes back about 30 years, but it has happened within the past couple of years as well. was just wondering if they were trying to give me some kind of message.
They're trying to get a message to Bill. Are they trying to get a message to Bill?
So what they're probably doing is seeing their reflection in your window. You'll also see birds do it in the mirrors, side mirrors of cars. And they think it's a competitor. You especially see it in cardinals, you know, big red showy birds that that red's going to reflect. They'll definitely catch their reflection in that image, and they're trying to drive that predator away. So usually putting something into the window to kind of break up that reflection will usually deter them pretty quickly.
It says birds don't know what glass is. Glass has only been around these birds for, what, 100 years or so, and birds have been around for perhaps tens of millions. They're seeing the reflection, as Doug said, and they're responding to it as if there's another cardinal. That just, the darn thing will not go away. Every time he goes to that perch, that competitor is right there to challenge him. And that is a, sort of a symptom of a bigger problem of birds not recognizing glass. It's sort of silly when the cardinal is attacking its own reflection. It's a huge waste of his time and energy. Injuries are rare but do happen. But it shows why up to a billion birds a year are killed by hitting windows. And that's in flight because they're not responding. They're seeing the reflection of trees and sky. As for stopping a cardinal, you do want to break up the reflection. And what we often find, it's one perch that they go to, then they see that competitor. You could often figure out where it stands. And one of the simplest, easiest ways, and our store has some products that make it a little more permanent, take a bar of soap, wipe out the reflection on the outside surface of the glass where in line with that perch, and after a couple of visits to that perch, that competitor is finally gone. Soap washes off by the time it rains, and that usually solves the problem.
We were talking about vagrancy earlier. Melanie writes on Facebook, we have a blue finch here in Bodenham, a vagrant, and we are wondering if they might be escapees from captivity.
Blue finch sounds like it could be an indigo bunting.
Yes, we do have a couple native blue finches, or finch-like birds. Indigo bunting is actually fairly common in Maine in certain habitats, and there are some very unusual and uncommon birds such as blue grosbeaks. Without knowing exactly what the bird looks like, I wouldn't pass judgment on it. However, I can say that there is a huge and unbelievably extensive trade in cage birds, both legal and illegal, and captive birds, and birds do get out, some released. Some get out on their own, and there's all sorts of weird things that can show up in a yard because of this.
So something weird showed up in my yard, which I had never seen. This bird had kind of, it was fast and it ran. It showed no interest in flying, and it ran into the yard and kind of ran up to the house and looked around. It was about a foot tall, looked around really quickly and ran very quickly back into the woods. I've never seen one since. I don't live on a shore. I know it's hard to say what could it be, but are there a lot of birds that run around like that?
Short tail, long tail.
I think it was a short tail.
Okay, I would point towards some sort of grouse.
Yeah.
And then also some escape birds. The fact that it, you know, came running right up to your house.
Right.
You know, there's things like bobwhites in the state, or other game birds that are just. Basically dodging bullets out there.
Okay, all right. Yeah. I thought I'd seen these. I thought I knew game birds, but anyway, who knows? We've got a lot more calls. We're going to go to Ted in Hollowell and Diane in Lubeck, but first we're going to take a short break. This is Maine Calling. We'll be right back.
You make Maine Calling possible, as does CEI, working with small and medium-sized businesses focusing on economy, equity, and environment. CEIMaine.org. And Baxter Brewing Company in Lewiston, committed to canning their entire line to protect the beer and the environment. BaxterBrewing.com. MPBN Radio constantly strives to offer the best possible programming at the most convenient times. And if you appreciate classical music, it is actually available 24 hours a day online at MPBN.net. Classical music all the time, wherever you want. Simply click on Listen Live at the top of the page. MPBN.net also offers a live stream of our main on-air programming for those times when you are not near a radio or find yourself where our on-air signal may not reach well. Stay tuned after Maine Calling for our Public Affairs Hour at 1 o'clock. We'll present the Commonwealth Club of California, hosting Steve Forbes, Chairman and Editor-in-Chief of Forbes Media and author of Money, how the destruction of the dollar threatens the global economy, and what we can do about it. Coming up at 1 o'clock here on MPBN.
And welcome back. I'm Keith Shortall. You're listening to Maine Calling. Today on the program, all things avian. With me in the studio, Patrick Keenan, who directs the River Point Bird Migration Center in Falmouth, Doug Hitchcock, staff naturalist at Maine Audubon, and Derek Lovich, who owns Freeport Wild Bird Supply and leads bird watching expeditions. Give us a call. The number, 800-399-3566. That's 800-399-3566. We'll go to the phones and to Ted and Hollowell in one moment. But we had a few questions from folks about squirrels in feeders and what to do. Derek?
Sure. It's certainly what my business is about. It's about getting people to enjoy birds. And one of the ways to enjoy them is to not be frustrated by the things that are going wrong. There's a lot of bad ideas out there about how to keep squirrels off feeders. There aren't a lot of options. Feeder placement has something to do with it. But simply a properly sized metal baffle on a properly placed pole is going to be 100% squirrel proof. As long as you put it where they can't leap, and we know roughly the vertical leaping ability of squirrels, vertical and horizontal leaping ability, a baffle's gonna work if there aren't things overhanging, and that's what I mean by proper placement, just to simplify things. If done right, it doesn't take much. It doesn't take any frustration. There's no stress involved. It can be done.
What are some of the bad ideas?
Grease on a pole is a terrible idea. If birds wipe up against that or it drips off, they could either ingest it or even die of hypothermia because their feathers are so important for insulating. It often doesn't work. Squirrels will just learn to wipe it off. Certainly, using a gun on a squirrel is usually counterproductive. By removing one squirrel or multiple squirrels, you cause all the surrounding territories to respond by reproducing more to fill that void. Nature abhors a vacuum. So those surrounding nests, they don't know what happened. They just know, hey, we got to make more kids because there aren't enough squirrels around.
So baffles. All right, let's go to Ted in Hollowell. Hi, Ted.
Yes.
Yeah, hi, go ahead, please.
I have a hay field behind my house. And as the hay matures in mid-May, we get a lot of bobolinks that come into the hay field. They're there for maybe a month, and I assume that's when they're nesting and, laying eggs, and then the young are fledging. What happens to them after that? Because they're usually gone, let's say, by June 15th. Do they migrate thereafter? Is this the northern bound of their migration? Is that what we're seeing?
Patrick?
Ted, I'd actually like to address this a little more generally and talk about, we mentioned vagrancy earlier. And I think that, a couple things happen. We have vagrancy, which is just this crazy movement of a bird in some direction to somewhere that it may or may not have been before. But the seasonal cycle of birds after birds nest, which sounds like they could be doing here in your hay fields, there's a period where birds disperse. And that process involves a dispersal of birds that hatch in a place around into the surrounding areas, probably looking for habitats or areas that they may return to in future years and try to nest. And then at some point, what your bobolink do is they begin to migrate. And that probably starts for bobolink and Doug and Derek chime in here, probably in late summer and August, and then continuing through September. And those birds go tremendous distances at that point. And I think one of the things for people listening that they should be aware about is just the tremendous physiological changes and kind of marathon events that these migrations are for many species of birds. So I hope I answered your question and kind of put in some other info in there that's helpful.
Yeah. And one thing I'd love to add, referring back to the State of the Birds report, grassland birds are one of the hardest hit birds right now, just as we're seeing that land use really changing. And so if you do have things like bobolinks, I would certainly encourage folks kind of mow as late as possible. I think you had said early June was when these birds were showing up. When males are displaying on territory, they're going to be much more detectable. If there were a few around, by the time they're nesting, they don't want to be quite as obvious. So it's not going to be until usually mid to late July that they'll pretty much be wrapping up fledging, when those chicks are going to be able to fly off on their own. So we usually recommend into August if people can delay mowing their fields that long.
Okay. I've got two questions about people spotting some Canada geese with another goose with them and wondering if it's a snow goose. One of those people is Carl in Owl's Head. Hi, Carl.
Hello.
Hi, go ahead, please.
thank you for taking my call. I'm on the coast in Owl's Head, and the past 2 years in September, there's been a flock of Canada geese that's come by. Both times it had a snow goose, single snow goose, within the flock. Probably 10 days ago, there was also a flock here, and again, a single snow goose. And I wonder whether this is a snow goose, which is traveling with this flock all year long, or is it just an aberrancy? Right. It's 3 years in a row now that I've seen this.
So this is an ugly duckling, Derek?
Unlike a lot of the other birds we've talked about, that of migration, where migration is innate and it's built in, it's an instinct, waterfowl actually have to learn how to migrate. They're taught by their parents, and sometimes they get separated and can wander with a different group of birds. That is absolutely possible here, and we do have instances where snow geese do travel from the tundra with Canada geese. Other even rarer geese sometimes arrive here in Maine in mixed flocks or with a flock of Canada geese. Sometimes they'll stay. We now have resident Canada geese in Maine. These aren't birds flying south in July. They're here all summer now. And sometimes we will have a wild bird that was a migrant no longer migrate as it stays with those. We also have, as we also mentioned earlier, escaped geese. And a lot of waterfowl are kept in collections, and a lot of our domestic ducks are white. And certainly at our store, we get a lot of photos and reports of snow geese that turn out to be fairly common domestic geese, some of which can fly pretty well. So if it's a snow goose of a wild variety, it may simply be a vagrant that decided to stay there or didn't know any better because it followed some resident geese, or it's a bird that's just surviving on its own in the great outdoors without our help.
Well, it's nice that they let them in and let them fly with them, right? Very kind to an otherwise, I think, mean bird. But anyway, to Lubeck now and Diane. Hi, Diane.
Hi.
Hi, go ahead, please.
I have been hearing a two-note call most of the summer, and I got to identify it twice, and I feel quite certain it's a Harris sparrow out of its territory. But then this morning, when you just played these five bird calls, I heard this two note, and I thought, but you identified it as an eastern phoebe. I looked it up, listened to it on my iPad, and it definitely is not an eastern phoebe that I have been seeing and hearing. Well, when I first heard it, I was thrilled, and now I'm concerned. It's sounding mournful, and I'm wondering, will he ever find his way in, you know, will other birds befriend him? Will he ever find his way back? Yeah, well, if I did identify it correctly, which I...
Sure, we'll help you maybe try to identify it. But Doug, we were talking earlier, and I played actually a chickadee, and you said many people believe that phoebe call of the chickadee is a phoebe, but did I get that right?
Right. So phoebes are start with the black-capped chickadee. Their typical song is that lovely two-noted phoebe, phoebe, where our eastern phoebes that we have here have a harsher, they do kind of say their name as they call, but it's harsh, not musical at all. I would be a little suspect of a Harris sparrow spending the summer here. Maine's had 8 records before, mostly just overshooting vagrants that don't seem to linger too long. So I'd point you towards a chickadee for that song. And then, you know, thinking about what they kind of look like with dark caps, I would reassess that as a possible answer.
Can we play the phoebe song again there? Just the beginning.
That's the chickadee.
Yeah.
The chickadee.
Did that sound like it, Diane? Is Diane still there?
I feel I'm very confident it's the Harris sparrow.
Okay.
I haven't had a second ID. I had a very close ID for 10 minutes. I was watching him.
Gotcha.
He was like 10 feet away from me. But anyway, I don't have a second backup on that. But I guess my question is, if it is Will other birds befriend him? Is he calling for family? Will he ever find his way back when they do lose their way?
Diane's worried about the bird.
I am.
So if it's lasted this long, that means it was probably finding plenty of food and might know how to find its way back. I don't think birds are too concerned, especially some of those non-flocking species. Probably not too concerned with making friends, especially as a vagrant. But I'll also always encourage people, if you think you've got a rare bird, even quite often with a terrible photo or now with phones that can record audio, I'm sure all three of us in the room here would love to help ID a possibly rare bird.
Sure. Let's go to Bath and Mariah. Hi, Mariah.
Hi. Oh, wonderful program. Thank you. Yeah. I'm an old bird watcher. I'm 85 now. I've been watching birds since I was 15. But lately, we have Carolina wrens here in the winter, right in the Bath area. And I wondered if they're just coming up north and there's no one seeing them or hearing them northward from here, but they're here all winter. Okay, so I'd like to know more about the Carolina wrens. But also, I am concerned about the warblers. I've seen so few. I've been watching warblers all my life here in Maine. Why? Has there been an environmental problem for them? Because we have so few different species right here where I used to see a lot.
Okay, I don't want to run out of time, and I want to get to both of these. So who wants to do the Carolina wren?
I could go ahead and do
okay.
that. Carolina wrens are one of a group of southern birds that are moving north. Cardinals, red-bellied woodpeckers, tufted titmice, these birds are steadily moving north in a combination of reasons, climate change certainly being one of the large factors. Carolina wrens are becoming much more regular in yards in the southern third of Maine, and they're now found now and again throughout the state. This is new. 20 years ago, the last caller may have been calling about her Carolina wren as a vagrant. Now it's a bird that I hear regularly in people's yards, especially at feeders and in suburban areas that give them the habitat that they need.
Also a question about the warbler, and is the warbler in trouble, Doug?
Yeah, I think we can point to those as you know, especially birds that are nesting up in our forests, which you could point towards different land management issues. But especially thinking about where some of these birds are going during our winters and how those habitats are changing. So, you know, I would always encourage people, you know, drink your bird-friendly coffee. You know, think about these birds in the terms of where they're spending their entire lives and just the changing landscape that they're having to deal with.
Let's take one more call here. We'll go to Searsport and Henry. Hi, Henry. Quickly, if you could, please.
I was hoping to get some help with identifying a nest of birds that lodged this year for the first time under our burrow shed. And they sit on the fence wire and always flick their tails, and they're flycatchers. And they sound like Phoebe when they make their call. They had four hatchlings this year, and we see them around still now occasionally.
Well, Henry, you'll be happy to know I'm getting some nodding heads here in the studio. So some confidence? Or
it sounds like a perfect and very well-said description of an Eastern Phoebe. And they are often under our eaves and porches and sometimes on the light bulb above the camp entranceway.
And be aware, Henry, that bird may return to very nearby that nest next year, in fact.
So
to do that.
For the Henrys out there, and myself included, who have a bird in the backyard that they just don't really know how to identify, what's the best way? What's the resource? Take a picture, take a recording, send it where? Patrick?
Well, that's a good question. I'd volunteer, but I think everyone should call Doug.
I agree.
No. Well, I mean, there are resources online. There's actually a Facebook page devoted to identifying Maine birds where people can post photos. Field guides are very useful. I don't know.
There's a new app called, I think it's just called Merlin ID, maybe Merlin Bird ID. It's a free app put out by Cornell that essentially by answering about 5 questions, you tell it where you are, when, roughly the size of the bird, and then pick some of the common colors that you see on it. It will know based on your area what the most abundant birds are, what you're likely to be seeing. So it's a great free tool for people to use.
And people should, in the meantime, take a walk, right?
Yeah.
Go birding. All right. Thank you all for being here. Patrick, Derek, and Doug, thanks for being here.
Thanks for having
Thank
us.
You.
Doug Hitchcock, staff naturalist at Maine Audubon, Derek Lovich, owner of Freeport Wild Bird, and Patrick Keenan is the Biodiversity Research Institute. With them, he is an outreach director for the organization and director of the River Point Bird Migration Center in Falmouth. Jonathan Woodward ran the board today. Jennifer Rooks answered your calls and helped produce the program. We also had additional help from the MPBN web team. You can find past editions of Maine Calling as well as a link to our podcast by visiting mpbn.net/Maine Calling. Tomorrow on the program, is your basement or attic overflowing with things you just can't let go of? I'll help you deal with that. I'm Keith Shortall. You've been listening to Maine Calling on the Maine Public Broadcasting Network.